This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 80 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be discussing Season 5 of Star Trek Deep Space Nine as we continue our Essential Trek Philosophy series. Zachary, how are you, sir?
Doing great. I am looking forward to talking about Season 5 of Deep Space Nine, mainly because this is one of my favorite seasons of Star Trek in general. Although I found it remarkably difficult to put together a list of essential Trek philosophy, partly because I feel like at this point in Deep Space Nine, they are firmly entrenched in the Dominion War, and so many stories in the season revolve around that plot point, right? Mm-hmm. It's all about the Dominion War, and there are a few interesting ethical stories. There are a few interesting stories, I would say, about virtue ethics, personal character virtues of the characters that we see, and their failings and strengths, but nothing that I would really classify as, like, deep abstract philosophy. It's all very much practical ethics, the ethics of war, the ethics of character traits and virtues. So I found this remarkably difficult to put together this list. How about you?
I enjoy the less abstract disciplines of philosophy. So what's not to love about the fifth season of Deep Space Nine? First of all, you have the fact that this season was unfolding during the 30th anniversary of Star Trek, Zachary, and I really think that Rick Berman and Ira Bear really brought their A game this entire season in terms of content. I mean, certainly we all associate Trials and Tribulations with this season, which is probably my all-time favorite episode of Star Trek for the sheer nostalgia of it. But there's so much more folded into this season. Honestly, I find it to be one of the more philosophically robust seasons of Deep Space Nine because I do like those ethical plays, and there's a lot of that within the season of Deep Space Nine. And this may be, even for me, in the whole of Star Trek, one of the most robust seasons philosophically. I've come to the conclusion more and more that Star Trek, when it's at its best, is asking these sort of hard existential questions. The original series probably did it best, but they did it really well in TNG and certainly here in Deep Space Nine. In fact, one of the things that I appreciate most about Deep Space Nine is the way it delves into these existential explorations without being so black and white about it. There are lots of shades of gray within Deep Space Nine. And Zachary, as you and I have often observed, Star Trek is at its best when it asks questions but almost never provides answers or draws conclusions. It leaves it to us, the fans. We get to think about it and come to our own inference.
So, Mike, you're saying that we're moving from our last episode of Metatrex, the red shirt edition on the philosophy of color, a very abstract topic, to shades of gray.
Absolutely. We have gone from the spectrum of colors to this monochromatic universe of Deep Space Nine.
But at least it's more practical.
It's practical. Right. But, you know, Season 5 of Deep Space Nine is that kind of Star Trek, though. And it's for that reason that I found it really difficult, for me at least, to sift through and choose a mere few episodes for this podcast to present. This season's like those darn tribbles, Zachary. You know, just when you think you've found good philosophy to talk about, it just keeps multiplying. I mean, you've got A plots, you've got B plots, you've got overall story arcs that really have some great ethical philosophy, these wonderful existential questions. I mean, it's like Captain Kirk opened the chute and we're waist deep in furry little philosophical threads.
I think where I struggle in coming up with my list on our episodes of Essential Trek Philosophy is when I encounter a season of Star Trek where my favorite episodes in the season are sort of my personal favorite episodes, not necessarily the episodes that are most philosophically rich. Sometimes they really do match up, and my favorite episodes are the ones that I find the most philosophically rich, and that's a happy accident. I think in this season, so many of my favorite episodes are not the ones I would put on my list for the purpose of this episode. So I have to go looking, sort of diving into the depths of the episodes. I don't tend to rewatch as much. I don't tend to count among my list of personal favorite episodes, but still the most philosophically important.
I could relate to that. And I should also say, Zachary, that some of these episodes are very familiar to us and possibly to our listeners. As I was combing through, I found a number of them we've discussed on previous podcasts.
Yeah, we've already covered this season, haven't we?
Yeah.
Didn't we just do this?
In many ways, though, that makes it easier to choose, but in some ways, it's much more difficult. But as we've observed, this is Essential Trek Philosophy. So regardless of past discussions and observations, that's what I'm here to talk about.
It just means it takes the pressure off. We don't have to say very much. We can just go see Metatrex episode 47.
Go back in the back catalog. We've talked about this one before. As a matter of fact, I posted in the Babel conference today that we were recording, and I asked the delegates there in the Babel conference what their pick was for Essential Trek Philosophy from the fifth season of Deep Space Nine, and we got a few responses back. In fact, one of them come from our good friend Duncan Barrett, who noted that we had had a lengthy discussion about Children of Time in the past. So he remembered that particular episode and made note of it in his comment. And we'll be sharing some more of those during the podcast today.
We haven't often taken listener polls on Metatrex in real time, posting beforehand what we're going to talk about and getting some feedback on the Babel conference. But that's a fun precedent to start. I think maybe we should do that from time to time.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. And I've enjoyed seeing the responses that we've gotten from our listeners. And some of their choices actually line up with a few of my own. So I think this is going to be fun to kind of weave those into our discussion here today.
Well, there's a danger that we present ourselves as the quote-unquote experts on Star Trek and philosophy, which we kind of are. I studied philosophy and I've been a lifelong Star Trek fan, so if anyone's qualified to be an expert on Star Trek and philosophy, it's probably me. But philosophy is not an expert-oriented discipline. It's more conversational and Socratic and inclusive, and I wouldn't want to presume to have the final word on anything we talk about on Metatrek. So it's always fun to get listener feedback on anything we talk about on Metatrek.
Absolutely. And we've often made that distinction that we're not the final authority on any of this. So we always encourage our listeners to go to our show thread and continue the conversation. That's all we're doing. We're a couple of guys having a philosophical conversation that happens to be anchored in the Star Trek universe.
Especially on these list episodes, my list is going to be different from your list, which will be different from our listeners' lists, and we find comparing those lists interesting.
And that's a great segue into reminding our listeners, Zachary, how this works. So this is Essential Trek Philosophy, and we are going season by season, series by series, in reverse order, and choosing, each of us, a list of episodes based on their philosophical content. And as you just mentioned, we do not share our lists. I don't know what's on your list. You don't know what's on my list. Sometimes we match up, sometimes we don't. And that's the fun of it. So at the end of this podcast, what we hope to be able to present our listeners is a great snapshot of an entire season, in this case, Deep Space Nine Season 5, and they can do a philosophical rewatch and just kind of catch the highlights of the season based on the philosophical content within that season. So, shall we dive in?
Okay, so my first pick is an episode we've talked about before, predictably, since we mentioned that we talked about some of these episodes on previous episodes of Metatrex, Children of Time. Mm-hmm. Which happens to be, actually, this is one of my all-time favorite episodes of Star Trek in general, not just in this season, but in general, and it did make my list, so ignore everything I said earlier about my favorite episodes not making my list. This one is one of my favorite episodes, and it made my list, and it was probably the easiest pick. This is the episode where the crew of the Defiant encounters their descendants in an alternate timeline stuck on a planet in the Gamma Quadrant. I find this episode interesting for a couple of reasons. Two main reasons, really. One, I think it raises the question of legacy. You know, who are you and what do you leave behind and what's the meaning of your life? And it's interesting to see the descendants of the Defiant crew, there's kind of reverence they have and recognition they have of their, what are from their point of view, ancestors, you know, 200 years, in the past. So that's one thing I like about the episode. The other thing I like about this episode is that it's almost a classic problem in utilitarianism. You have a small number of people on the Defiant who want to get back to their lives, and it raises questions of making the choice between their own lives and their own futures and their own quality of life, potentially being marooned on this planet in the past versus returning to the space station and living out the rest of their lives. But if they make the choice to return to their lives, they're potentially sacrificing the thousands of lives on this planet. So it's kind of a classical utilitarianism problem, a small number of people and their quality of life and their rights, their right to live their own lives and pursue their own happiness versus the greater good of a larger number of people. So I find that a fairly classic example in utilitarianism versus individual liberty, individual autonomy, individual rights to pursue what we would call life, liberty, and happiness, pursuing your own life.
This was actually on my list as well, Zachary, for all the reasons that you mentioned. And we actually had a pretty lengthy discussion about this episode on Metatrex number 53, entitled Saving Major Kira. We talked in detail about some of the philosophical threads in this episode. And you're right, it's about legacy. And there were some great moral and ethical plays within it, but there was just that really neat thread of genealogy and legacy, and for me it was just rich. It is one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek. Like you, I really enjoy this episode beyond just the philosophy of it. So it was actually number two on my list, and Duncan had mentioned that it was probably his top choice, although he did offer another episode that we'll talk about later. But Duncan Barrett, our good friend here at the network, enjoys this episode as well. It's just philosophically, it's very rich. It delves into a lot of those abstract themes that I know that you like, that I'm not as well versed on. But there is this really strong moral and ethical play, and they're asking existential questions that I think are very well presented in this wonderful science fiction format that, you know, these are decisions and choices that mere mortals like us will never have to face. But they do it in such a way that it does address some of the questions that come up from time to time in life as we're facing these moments of existential crisis, and we're asking those hard questions. They're just doing it in a very Star Trek way, in a very futuristic way, in a very science fiction way that we'll never be faced with that situation. But it's a great episode.
While you were affirming my intuitions on this episode, I happened to be browsing the Wikipedia page listing all of the episodes for season 5 of Deep Space Nine, and I was kind of amused by the really short descriptions of these episodes. So I think this is now going to be a thing where, because I pretty much am terrible at giving synopses. I'm like, things happen and stuff happens, and I can't remember the details. I'm not a detail guy. I'm an idea guy. So I thought it would be fun to read these synopses, because I think they're so bad. So for Children of Time, we get, an accident causes the crew to meet their own descendants and presents them with an ethical dilemma. Nice and precise.
They're leaving out so much.
So there is an ethical dilemma, but they have to basically decide amongst themselves to return to their lives, potentially sacrificing thousands of people, or sacrificing their own happiness for the greater good of those thousands of people.
Mm.
Sounds like a trolley problem if I ever heard one.
That is definitely a trolley problem. Well, Zachary, you and I agree on this episode. It's on both of our lists. Next up on my list is the episode Nor the Battle to the Strong. I really feel like this is an underappreciated episode that, again, asks hard questions. They ask questions about courage and cowardice. Jake is becoming a man, but he hasn't had to really face his own mortality in any real way. So at first he's presented a Federation soldier who, by most accounts, has done something very cowardly, and he's injured himself in order to escape the front lines of this battle with the Klingons. And we all know that Klingons fight with utter brutality. So what we're presented here is the brutality of war. In much the same way, I think, if we were to go back in history, I think that there's a lot of parallels to this and possibly what someone like Ernest Hemingway would have experienced going off to World War II, or World War I, rather. What I love about this episode is that it challenges the notion of judging the actions of others, because Jake later finds himself in a hostile situation. He and Dr. Bashir are taking fire, and he finds himself running away from danger, and it causes him this incredible existential crisis. He looks himself in the mirror, and he does not like what he sees. He weighs his actions against that of the ensign that had injured himself, and he's come to the conclusion, you know, I must be a coward. And meanwhile, in the B-plots, Commander Sisko, Captain Sisko, is facing a crisis of his own. There's nothing he can do to protect his son in a war zone. He's having to let go of his son. This episode is so rich with dialogue, I think, that just frames the existential crisis that's happening in this episode so well. There's a conversation going on between Jake and this ensign, and they're relating to one another. Jake is experiencing this internal struggle, and as he listens to this ensign pour his heart out about what he experienced and why he did what he did, you know, Jake sees a reflection of himself. He relates to him. So all of a sudden, this judgment that's been passed on this ensign that he's a coward, you know, wow, it doesn't seem, you know, so cowardly. The ensign says to Jake, it's funny. One minute life's moving along just like you always thought it would, and the next you do something that changes everything, that makes you realize you're not who you thought you were. At the academy, I did really well in the battle simulations. I never had any problems. But when you're out there and the live shells are detonating all around you, it's a whole different thing. Zachary, that is an existential crisis if I've ever heard of one. And that's why I love this episode, because, again, it's asking hard questions about, you know, what is courageous and what is cowardly.
Well, you mentioned the brutality of war, and I find this interesting because here in our 21st century, relatively civilized Western society, we rightly find war and the chaos and brutality and violence of it repugnant. You know, there's something less ideal about that than a state of peace and a state of tranquility, right, that we see here in the Western world. And sadly, some people in parts of the world have never experienced that peace and tranquility. They've lived in a constant state of war and fear. But for me, it raises the question of whether there are rules of engagement. Is there a civilized way to conduct war? Or is the whole notion of war more along the lines of Thomas Hobbes' State of Nature, where you're outside of civilized society, outside of rules of engagement? You know, here in the Western world, we kind of have civilized rules of engagement, right? You don't target civilians, and there's rules about who you can lob missiles back and forth at. And there's, you know, we kind of like to pretend that there's this civilized game about war, but war is nasty and brutish, right? When it comes right down to it, it's terrible. But is there a civilized way to wage war or not? Or when you're in a state of potential mutual annihilation, which is, you know, the state we're in a nuclear capable society here in the real world, it's the state that, it's a state that the Federation finds itself in relationship to the Dominion in Deep Space Nine, potential mutual annihilation. Are there rules in that situation, or all bets off at that point? You know, are you justified in doing anything it takes to preserve your own life, by extension, your own society, when faced with annihilation from another individual or another society? Or is there a more civilized way to conduct war? You know, can two warring parties agree to be civilized and follow the rules of engagement? I find that an incredibly tenuous concept.
That sounds like something out of a original series episode. Let's just simulate battle, and then we'll line the casualties up and we'll dispose of them in a more humane manner.
But that's essentially what we do. You know, we follow rules of engagement when we fight wars or skirmishes. We expect the people we're warring with to fight fair, quote unquote, and not lob missiles at the wrong kinds of people. And yeah, I find the whole thing very specious, for lack of a better word, when faced with the sheer brutality of war, as you described it a few minutes ago.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, the Klingons have a reputation for being particularly brutal, and that is starkly different than the way we waged war, say, 300 years ago, when we met on open fields of battle, and everything was very orderly, soldiers lined up, they fired shots, they were volleys.
It was a gentleman's game.
It was a gentleman's game, and that all changed during the American Revolution when the colonists began to fight a guerrilla-style warfare that was starkly different from what the British Army was used to. I mean, the British Army was the most powerful army on the planet at that time. But
the British were like, you can't hide behind that tree.
Yes.
That's not fair.
And you're shooting, you know, you're shooting commanders off their horses. You're not real gentlemen.
Real gentlemen stand there waiting to be shot.
But it changed warfare. And even that is supposed to be, you know, that type of guerrilla warfare. And for that matter, Zachary, in the Star Trek universe, they look back at atomic warfare as something that is just asinine. You know, to even think of, you know, why in the world, we even said that in a Deep Space Nine episode, why would they irradiate themselves in Little Green Men? So it's just an asinine concept that we would wage atomic warfare. And that seems so primitive to the people of the 24th century. And yet here we're fighting the Klingons, who are extremely hostile and who wage a very guerrilla-style warfare that's hand-to-hand. It's brutal. And Jake is, I think Jake is faced not only with his own mortality, but with the sheer shock and awe of the brutality of it all. And I think it sends him spiraling into this existential crisis where he has to look at himself and say, you know, am I man enough to face this? Am I man enough to stand up to this? I think he was weighing himself truly against Starfleet and against the Federation's principles. And, you know, I think there for a while he wasn't too sure. But in the end, I think Ben Sisko does an amazing thing for him, and that's to point out the internal courage that it took for him to put that in writing and then lay that all out for everybody to bare his soul for everybody to see.
That second aspect of the episode that you're describing, the way in which Jake is kind of comparing himself to the behavior of other people around him and finding himself to fall short, is interesting because so much of our self-identity is based on our experience, right? Mm-hmm. Starfleet officers have a certain set of experiences, a set of training, forming certain habits of reaction that prepare them for dangerous situations. But as you said, no amount of training can prepare you for the real crisis when it's right in front of you, right? Training is still a simulation to some degree. But so many of us fall into that trap, I think, of weighing ourselves against other people, you know, finding ourselves inadequate based on other people's experiences and other people's training and other right. people's abilities, rather than focusing on the things that make you unique, your own unique experiences, your own unique training, your own unique virtues. Not to radically individualize this, but I think we all, especially in this age of social media, where we're constantly comparing ourselves against other people's abilities and other people's experiences, mm-hmm. right? 24/7, you know, in real time in our Facebook feeds. You know, that can sort of spin you into something of an existential funk, right? Finding sure. yourself inadequate. And I think that's a symptom of modern society that's way more true today than it was 20 years ago in Deep Space Nine, and something that we see Jake experiencing to some degree, although in the midst of a crisis. But I'm talking about kind of in the ordinary sense, right? You know, other people, the achievements other people have in their lives, or their accomplishments, or their amazing activities, or their awesome hiking trip, or whatever it is, right? Whatever it is, right? We're all constantly comparing ourselves to other people, and that can spin you into a cycle if you're of depression or at least an existential funk, for lack of a sure. better word. I think he wants to be, for lack of a better word, a little more macho about it. Right? He's finding himself inadequate, and he's actually afraid. He doesn't see the fear that other people have learned to suppress or other people have learned to deal with. And he is bearing his own soul about the fear that, I mean, it's a normal reaction. You know, if something, if you're in a dangerous situation, you're going to be afraid. You're not going to have that courage necessarily. And he's ignoring the fact that other people around him all have this training and experience that he doesn't have, but he wants to be more adequate than he is. And I think we all have something like that in our lives.
Yeah. Even in the hospital, this kind of makeshift hospital that they've set up in this cave, you can see, and I have to say, Sir Auchinlockton plays this so well. He's wide eyed and he's looking around and he sees Dr. Bashir and the other medics in action. And I think that he's really taken back by how they're able to remain calm, cool, and collected in the midst of this chaos that's unfolding around them. And I think you hit the nail on the head. What he's forgotten is that they have an incredible amount of training and experience to fall back on that he just doesn't have. And I honestly think that this is one of those episodes of Star Trek that I think parents should sit down and watch it with their kids and have a conversation. This is a great teaching moment for any parent with a child. You know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, parents who have raised their children on Star Trek, like me, who have watched episodes of Star Trek with a parent. This is a great conversation starter. It's a great teaching episode to have that conversation with their kids and say, you know, listen, you are who you are. You're unique. You're an individual with your own gifts and talents and mindset, and that's good and that's okay. And you need to, you know, and with my help and with the help of learned people around you, find out what your strengths are and capitalize on those strengths and not judge and weigh yourself against the abilities of other people. I think this is a great episode all the way around, nor the battle to the strong.
Now that we're talking about this episode, it occurs to me that what you see in this episode, the idea of finding yourself kind of inadequate based on your experiences, comparing your own experiences to other people's experiences, might be an interesting, subtle, new kind of argument for what's known as the bundle theory of identity. This is a view that some empiricists hold about the nature of the self, that if you ask, well, what is the self, and try to give an analysis of what defines me as a person versus you as a person, our personal identity over time, some empiricists have held that you're essentially a bundle of your experiences, that, you know, the unique experiences, sensory experience and emotional experience, and, you know, this rich, complex network of experiences really define you as a person. That is that actually just is you. You are the sum of your experiences, almost literally in that regard. And that's kind of what we see here. You know, Jake is a different person than all the people around him, has different reactions, has different training. He's comparing himself, and that's a little sad, actually, that he's, you know, feels the need to compare himself to other people and their experiences. But he's a unique individual based on his unique experiences, just like the people in Starfleet around him. The medics that you described are unique people with their own unique experiences. They've got the training, you know, that's allowed them to deal with the situation. That's become who they are. They're medics. They're able to do that. And Jake doesn't have that experience. He doesn't have those reactions, hasn't built up the ability to deal with a crisis in that way. And I think those are, if anything's a defining characteristic of them as individuals, it's their different instinctive reactions based on their different experiences.
Well, Zachary, what's next on your list?
So I have, this is maybe a little, again, a little specious from a philosophy standpoint, but I think there's an important lesson to be learned from this episode. It's let he who is without sin, or the Risa episode.
Yes.
So again, in the interest of using these slightly humorous Wikipedia synopses as opposed to my own personal synopsis, this is the episode where, quote unquote, Worf and Dax vacation on the pleasure planet Risa and encounter unexpected dangers.
Yeah, a bunch of fundamentalist protesters.
Well, and I think that's it exactly. I think, you know, when this episode first aired, you know, you were coming out of the Jerry Falwell kind of era, mm-hmm. right? This TV preacher kind of fundamentalist image that people had. We've seen various takes on the notion of fundamentalism as opposed to progressivism and what that does to society or does to people or does to culture. And I don't want to be too judgmental about this. I know plenty of people that would consider themselves fundamentalists in a very ordinary, you know, non-harmful kind of way, right? Those aren't the people we're talking about. We're talking about fundamentalists who really take it to the extreme, right? I think, you know, what's interesting to me about this episode is you sort of think, like, in the 24th century, you know, a relatively progressive futuristic society, when most of the problems of society have been solved, it's a life of luxury on Ryza. Other than the war with Dominion, we generally have a peaceful society within the Federation. Why is there this strong need to return to a fundamentalist approach, you know, turn to the roots of the origin of true Federation, you know, beliefs and true Federation values? Why is there such a strong need to return to those kinds of things in an advanced society that's as idyllic as what you see in 24th century Federation society? I just find that interesting that even in the 24th century, no matter how good it gets, there will always be this impulse to go fundamentalist and return to the old ways.
Well, that's what I find interesting about this episode. I don't think it's so much about what we would call fundamentalism and this kind of socially liberal, some would even describe it as hedonistic sort of culture of the Federation, but
culture of the Federation.
I think this is.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, I think this is about extremism. I really think that this episode circles a lot around this idea of extremism. I mean, you're looking at these two kind of extremist sort of points of view. And Worf is put in a position where he feels like he has to choose. And isn't that Worf's dilemma?
Well, to bring it full circle, you previously mentioned Shades of Grey being part of the season. Worf does not do Shades of Grey. He's a black or white, one side or the other, no middle ground, take it to the extreme kind of guy.
Yeah, and here he is. He's faced with this choice. I mean, you know, is he going to side with his hedonistic girlfriend, or is he going to go with this... you know, this fundamentalist extremist Fullerton, you know, he's got to go one way or the other. He can't walk down the middle. Worf's not about the middle. He's going to go one way. He's going to go the other. And that's really what we're dealing with, is this idea of extremism.
Well, when faced with the war with the Dominion, you could understand the admonition not to get complacent, right? Don't rest on your laurels too much. The Dominion is approaching, right? They're coming. They're coming for us. We need to, you know, harden ourselves and be ready to face them when they come. We can't, you know, hang out on Ryza too much, because then we're not preparing for the war with Dominion. I kind of understand that reactive approach when faced with an impending war. I kind of understand that. Like, okay, you know, if you know there's a danger impending, you know, it's not a good idea to just rest on your laurels and do nothing and go have a good time. Okay, I understand that. But they really take it to extremes in this episode. Like, can't these guys go on vacation? What's so bad about a vacation, right? You know, I hate to see if this guy went to Las Vegas, I wonder what he would say.
Well, and I think that's what this is all about. This episode really is, because as I watch this, the message that Fullerton has is not a bad message. It's actually a very good message. You know, we know the Dominion's coming and we need to be ready, and we can't afford to, as you said, you know, be resting on our laurels. We've got to be prepared. That's not a bad message.
Dude, we need to cosplay this at Star Trek Las Vegas. We could be the dude running around saying that everyone needs to, you know, get back to true Federation values, and it's the, you know, the decline of 24th century society at STLV.
We could be standing in the lobby of the Rio. Absolutely.
Too much hedonism there in Las Vegas.
And our brown tunics. Yeah, in our brown tunics. Absolutely. I'll totally make a little weather device and we'll mess with the weather there.
I've never heard of anyone cosplaying this guy, but someone needs to.
Someone should.
If you're a cosplayer and you're even remotely entertained by this idea, make it happen and send us the picture.
Fullerton and I, you know, I could, I have a little less hair on top than you do. So I'll vote you to play Fullerton. I'll be the bullion that just kind of hung out and, you know, looked all serious all the time. Bullions always look serious.
So, Mike, you're kind of saying that you don't see this episode as a fundamentalism versus progressivism. you see this as a different variety of fundamentalism.
No, I wouldn't necessarily characterize it in that way.
It feels to me like at any point in society, there's a subset of people. Sometimes it's a small group, sometimes it's a large group, sometimes they're vocal, sometimes they're not. But they're the ones who are screaming that we've deviated from our true values. It happened in ancient Rome. It happened in ancient Greece. It happens in America. It happens pretty much anywhere at any period in time. There's some group of people saying we're deviating from the true way.
The conversation that you and I had about this episode all the way back in Metatrex 25, titled Feed Me Gawk.
55 episodes ago.
So
I'd almost forgotten we talked
about it. Yeah, Metatrex 25, we talked about Ryza and hedonism. So we really did circle around this idea of hedonism, and we talked about Fullerton and the response of the fundamentalists towards that. So if you want to hear a detailed conversation about Let He Who Is Without Sin, then go all the way back in our back catalog to episode 25 of Metatrex, Feed Me Gawk, and you'll get to hear a great discussion on the concept of hedonism in the Federation. And again, I think that this is about extremes, and I'm not stating my own position in any way, shape, or form. Just I'm saying I think this episode is about extremism, both for the fundamentalists and for the Federation.
See, now I sort of feel like there's just some fundamental group dynamics involved here. Like, every time you get a group of people and there's a bunch of people having fun, there's always one person who's like, you guys are having too much fun. You have to be more serious. You know, it's the old every party has a pooper. Every party has a pooper.
Well, and at the end of the episode, it was about getting Worf to find some middle ground. It wasn't about changing him necessarily and pulling him, you know, all the way over to the other side. It was about getting him to find some middle ground, loosen up, and find a balance between, you know, being who he is, ready for battle, and loosening up and enjoying a little bit of life and finding that middle ground. I think that was really the heart and soul of this episode.
Well, Jed Z is just going, geez, Fullerton, just have a little more Jamahar on, would you? Lighten up.
Although they did observe that they weren't sure that would help. So Fullerton must really have been...
He's too far gone.
Yeah, he's too far gone. But this was on my list as well, Zachary. That's two that you've picked.
Well, it's interesting because when we talked about this episode before, I found the notion of hedonism the most salient idea in this episode. 55 episodes of Metatrex later, I kind of find the group dynamics of fundamentalism more relevant for today. Like, you know, we see the ills and the evils of radical fundamentalism all around us in all of its forms. More so than 20 years ago, I think. We had annoying fundamentalists 20 years ago, and that's what we see in this episode. Now we have violent fundamentalists, and the world has, I think, gotten a bit more reactive and a bit more dangerous and a bit more chaotic as a result of the logical consequence of that kind of thinking. So I you know, today I find that more interesting than, you know, 55 episodes ago. I found the hedonism aspect of this episode most interesting.
I think that speaks to something that we've observed quite often, and that just addresses the timelessness, I think, of Star Trek in the way that it tells these stories. And as we move through time, these stories that they tell just don't lose their relevance. They just don't. They're timeless stories about timeless problems. And in this case, I think it's extremism. This kind of extreme position of fundamentalism and this extreme position of hedonism and, you know, finding the common ground, the middle ground between them. And, you know, I think there's an ebb and flow to time in which, you know, maybe 55 episodes ago, hedonism was on the rise. Well, now it's fundamentalism. They are a changing.
Well, times do change. And this is just a general comment about Star Trek episodes in general, but we can always circle back to them and find new meaning and find new relevance that we didn't see the last time we watched it.
So, yeah. Zachary, Let He Who Is Without Sin was also on my list. We've had a pretty good discussion about that to kind of supplement our already great discussion back in episode 25. You've got another episode to present?
I do. Again, it's kind of a lighthearted episode from a philosophy standpoint, but I think this is what's interesting about season 5 in general. I find a lot of the episodes in season 5 of Deep Space Nine to focus not so much on any particular ethical issue, although there are some episodes like that. A lot of the episodes are concerned with character traits and virtues, you know, the what makes up a virtuous Starfleet officer when faced with the chaos of war around them. And along those lines, my next pick is The Ascent. So purely because I'm getting a kick out of this, I'm going to read the Wikipedia summary because okay. It's fun. Forced to crash on a desolate planet, Odo and Quark learn they lost their communication system, replicator, and most rations in an explosion. But really, I think of this as the episode where Quark drags Odo up the mountain. With his broken, you know, with his broken non-changeling leg. Not quite kicking and screaming because his leg is broken, but... No, really, I this is just a simple thing that I love about this episode. You know, one of the virtuous character traits is fortitude. When faced with a crisis, when faced with your own limitations, when faced with something you have to accomplish, you can always dig a little deeper, find the strength, and muscle your way up the mountain. And just, it's just fun to see Quark, a little tiny Ferengi person, muscle up that inner strength to, you know, almost literally drag Odo up the mountain and find that internal strength to not die on that mountain.
I love this episode. It wasn't on my list. It was actually towards the bottom when I put together my initial list. I had about 10 or 11 episodes. This was down towards the bottom of that list. I love this episode. There's actually a really great compare and contrast in this episode within the A plot and the B plot, because in the B plot, we've got problems between Jake and Nog. So two friends who are faced with a small issue that really comes between them as friends. And that kind of compares and contrasts with Odo and Quark, who are two friends who don't want to admit that they're friends. And I love how their dilemma really brings that out into the open between the two of them. Neither of them are comfortable with it, but both of them, you know, face the fact that, you know, they're actually a little bit more fond of one another than what either of them are comfortable admitting, and how this tragedy, this trial that they've found themselves faced with, really brings out the best in them and the best of them. This idea of fortitude. I mean, we all know that Quark is a survivor. I mean, we all know that, but I don't even think Quark realizes at the beginning of this episode just how far he's willing to go to survive. And I love this episode. There's a great metaphor for the fact that they have to go uphill in the snow.
It's an uphill battle.
I think there's a great metaphor there.
I think my grandfather said something like that.
Yeah, once. Absolutely. Absolutely. But it is. It's a great metaphor, I think, for life sometimes. And it is uphill in the snow sometimes.
Just for the record, Mike, I would absolutely drag you up a mountain if necessary.
If your non-changeling leg were broken, I would totally give you the thermal suit and drag you up the hill.
Well, I think what we're seeing here in this episode is a different variety of ethics than we're used to thinking about ethics in Star Trek. We're used to thinking in terms of ethical dilemmas. This group of people versus that group of people. A large number versus a small number. The collective good versus the individual good. Those kinds of outright dilemmas. And here we don't see an ethical dilemma so much as the need to turn inward, dig inside, and find the strength. And that's a different variety of ethics. This notion that there are virtuous character traits that define praiseworthy individuals. And I think one of those character traits is fortitude. So I think you can think of this episode as a kind of philosophical virtue ethics analysis of a particular virtuous character trait.
And again, this is one of those Star Trek episodes that's so character driven. I mean, this isn't a pew pew episode. There's no epic space battles.
I'd like to see the pew pew version of this episode. You know?
This is just a great character driven episode that I think, in a lot of ways, is underappreciated for what it is. And it's definitely one of my favorites.
Yeah. So again, I don't know if I have any really deep philosophical takeaways from it, but I think that if you find character traits of people interesting and you recognize that some character traits are more virtuous than others, then you're more likely to find this kind of story interesting because it really spends time dwelling on those individual character traits that make these appealing characters or virtuous characters.
Yeah, great pick. Great pick. So, Zachary, next on my list is the episode The Ship.
That was not on my list.
I love this episode. Again, it is such a strong character-driven episode. In fact, this was, I mentioned earlier that our good friend Duncan Barrett, his show Primitive Culture, also on Trek FM, commented under the thread today that Children of Time, he noted that we did an episode on that. But he said The Ship was maybe, he said, quote, "The Ship is maybe the first truly quintessential DS9 episode, a very bleak, character-driven drama. It raises questions about trust." Maybe he said, maybe you can take that into game theory, and I think he's absolutely right. Cultural expectations and customs, and
he called it bleak.
Yes, raises questions about trust. Yeah, cultural expectations and customs and othering. One of my favorites. And I commented to him that this was one of my favorites as well. For me, this takes me back to my first love, the original series. And I think of episodes like The Enterprise Incident and Balance of Terror, where, and I, again, I think he's absolutely right. It's this game theory thing. It's getting in the head of the person on the other side. In this case, it's a Vorta. You know, they're playing this very complex game of chess in this episode with a Vorta who wants on that ship, and they're trying to figure out why. And they find out why. It's because there's a founder on that ship who's dying. And there's the dynamic of a comrade who is dying and, you know, different attitudes towards death. I think that's why Duncan perhaps thought of it as a very bleak character-driven drama, because there's a character dying, and Worf and O'Brien are having a debate over how to approach that officer's death. Are you honest with him? Are you dishonest with him? Do you be optimistic or do you be a realist? You know, how do you handle this? So it's this wonderful character-driven episode, I think, that really gets into this kind of, it's almost a psychological drama. And again, there are so many things going on here philosophically. I can't pinpoint one of them and say this is absolutely the philosophical takeaway. There's just so much here that this was actually number one on my list as far as philosophical episodes in the fifth season of Deep Space Nine.
I think of this kind of chess-like gamesmanship as really presenting a challenge against Federation ideals, because to the extent that you're sitting at the same table as your opponent is playing essentially the same game of chess, does that undermine the Federation's ability to claim moral superiority when they're essentially playing the same game of chess?
That's a great question. And I think that in a very abstract way, that question's raised within the episode to some degree. And there's this really interesting conversation at the end of the episode between Sisko and the Vorta about trust, And I think that there was a takeaway that, if we could have just trusted each other, we could have saved two lives today. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. And again, it takes me back to the original series, and I think that there's a very original series way that they told this story that I find very satisfying. It's and there is some pew-pew in this episode, but it's a very character-driven episode. I think it's very psychological in nature and just very interesting, and there's so much going on philosophically that I've watched this episode literally probably a dozen, maybe 10, 12 times, and each time I've taken away something different from it. It just never fails to satisfy me in terms of what it has to say.
Well, I think it shows the destructive spiral that can happen when there's a lack of trust on all parties, right?
Oh, truly.
Yeah, I mean, think from little crises to big crises. Think how much pain and suffering is caused by a lack of trust. And if everyone just calmed down and said, okay, we're all going to trust each other now, then, you know, you might be able to get out of the crisis with minimum harm done.
But yeah, and the great
sadly, that happens all too seldom.
Yeah, and the great thing about, and to Duncan's point about game theory, you know, the great thing here is for the Federation, the prize is that ship. And sadly for the Vorta, the prize was the changeling, the founder that she obviously valued much more than the ship or even taking those Federation prisoners. She just wanted that Vorta returned safely, and unfortunately, it didn't happen in the episode. The Federation got their prize, but unfortunately, the Vorta didn't get hers. But you know, there's a lot of game theory in this. I think that's really fascinating. This anticipation of, you know, what's my opponent's next move and how am I going to respond to it? You know, thinking several moves in advance. You see a lot of that kind of calculation going on in this episode. I think that's very reminiscent of a lot of the, you know, Romulan type episodes and Klingon episodes of the original series that we all love so well because of, you know, those kind of psychological and ethical plays.
What do you think about this plot point of the Jem'Hadar on the ship committing suicide because they've allowed the death of one of their quote-unquote gods?
Well, I find it fascinating.
One of their quote-unquote cult leaders.
Yeah, well, I find it fascinating because, and you just noted, I mean, we see this in our own world. And I think it's definitely a statement by Star Trek to the tragedy of that kind of action, and it was tragic.
Well, we often in Deep Space Nine we see several instances of this. We see a Federation or Starfleet character telling someone in the Jem'Hadar, but you're an individual. You know, you don't have to be subservient. They're not real God. You know, there's this whole false God aspect. And there's this, reminding the Jem'Hadar that they're people and individuals. And, you know, it's an interesting kind of take on individualism that, you know, we see sort of radical non-individualism from the Jem'Hadar. They're bred to be soldiers, for lack of a better word. They're bred to be subordinate. They view themselves as subservient to these false gods that they're under. And then, you know, they all commit suicide in a drink the green Kool-Aid kind of way. And it is an interesting commentary on the need for a robust sense of individualism.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, Zachary, we've seen this so many times in our own history, in entire cultures that were so duty bound and honor bound that if their duty or honor were even called into question, then there is that expectation there that they would take their own life. And I mean, we've seen that even as late as the 20th century. We see it in some cultures even today, but you know, it was prevalent even in the 20th century that there were, you know, cultures, you know, here on our own planet and our own time that, you know, this was a cultural expectation. You failed. Well, so, you know, literally fall on your sword.
Well, I mentioned that I see so much of virtue ethics inside season 5 of Deep Space Nine. I think this is a great example because these are virtues, duty and honor. These are qualities that we prize ourselves. We think those are virtuous, but so much of virtue ethics is about finding the Aristotelian middle ground or the golden mean between two opposing vices or two opposing weaknesses. And I think duty and honor is a great example. If you have so much duty and honor that you're willing to commit suicide for your false gods, that is too much duty and honor. If you have so little duty and honor that you're a coward or that you are not willing to rise to the occasion, you're not willing to do your part, whatever it is, that you don't have enough duty and honor. So, you know, oftentimes finding the virtuous character trait is a matter of finding that natural middle ground, having just enough duty and honor where you're going to do your part and you're going to have some bravery, but you're not going to drink the green Kool-Aid for your false gods.
Great episode, The Ship. Zachary, what's next on your list?
So, Mike, you might have been able to guess this, but my next pick is The Begotten, and that is an episode that you and I talked about in episode 51 of Metatrex, which we called Dr. Mora's Jell-O Mold, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And I think in all of Star Trek, you won't find a better episode on medical and scientific ethics than this particular episode.
I agree completely. This was actually on my long list. I shaved it off. It was kind of down at the bottom in lieu of some other picks that were a little stronger for me. But this is a great episode of Deep Space Nine. And I think just the simple fact that we've already covered it in talking about scientific and medical ethics, I agree with you wholeheartedly that this is one of the finest examples of that in all of Star Trek, that we really get to see it, you know, laid out and debated right before our eyes. It's a strong episode. I think there's some great ethical plays going on within it as Odo struggles with his own existentialism. And again, I think that's this recurring theme throughout this season of Deep Space Nine, you know, kind of figuring out, am I merely the sum of my past, or can I move beyond that and really enjoy the present and appreciate, you know, where my life is headed, what trajectory it's on from here. And I think it's a lot about his relationship with Dr. Mora, in essence, his own father. And I think that speaks to a lot of, you know, the moral and ethical struggles that we all have. I think all of us at some time or another have that kind of struggle relating to our own fathers and, you know, reconciling those relationships oftentimes later on in life. I think there's a lot to offer in this episode, even beyond the scientific and medical ethics.
I think what Star Trek does brilliantly is that it doesn't just present an ethical dilemma, although it does that very well in many, many cases. It also humanizes the ethical dilemma by showing the impact on characters. You know, so this is an example of medical ethics. You know, here in the real world, we experiment on other creatures. You know, we poke and prod the white mice to learn things about them, right? And we know that it hurts them, but we kind of ignore it for the sake of the knowledge that we get out of it, more or less. And there are, of course, people that care more about that than others and protest and try to make that not happen and find other alternatives. And other people just turn a blind eye and forget that it ever happens and everything in between. But here is an interesting example. This episode is basically, you know, Odo the white mouse grows up, is able to express his feelings, and is upset about the fact that he was poked and prodded when he was a little white mouse. It's as if a little white mouse grew up and was able to express the pain that it felt while it was being experimented on. How much would that change our perception of what we do to other creatures here in the real world? And that's exactly what happens in this episode.
Well, and the great thing is that he's faced with the dilemma of being on the other side of that scenario. You know, now he's the one doing the poking and the prodding, and he knows that he's dealing with a little white mouse here that's going to probably
grow up and resent him. He's like, ooh, look, I can make it move.
And I think that's something that as we grow beyond our childhood and we become adults and parents ourselves, I find myself facing those same issues and struggles sometimes, because I find myself, I'm no longer the child, I'm the parent. And, you know, faced with having conversations and dealing with my child, my daughter, who's now 15 years old, I've got a teenager. And, you know, I can remember very well what it was like to be the teenager. So, you know, trying to make sure that I do things in such a way that, you know, maybe as a parent, I'll get by and she won't grow up to resent me. So,
don't you think in this episode, though, Odo looks like he's having a little bit too much fun at one point? He's like, oh, look, I can poke the little baby changeling in the brain and make it jiggle.
He does have a quirky little smile in that episode as he elicits reactions from the baby changeling.
Well, and I think what changes the map here is that changelings have potential, right? Unlike a white mouse, that it's essentially going to be, however cute and cuddly it is, however much it can feel pain, it's still going to essentially be a white mouse at the end of the day, right? A changeling has greater potential in terms of human-like qualities in it, right? Odo is sentient. He's a security officer on Deep Space Nine. He's got interests and feelings and has interpersonal relationships. It's way more complicated than for a white mouse. And I think that's what changes the map. Odo is seeing the future potential when he's getting pleasure out of poking and prodding the infant changeling. Unlike when you poke and prod an experiment on a white mouse, it causes pain. You know, there's going to be some scientific knowledge that comes out of that. But there's no real potential there in a way that there is for the infant changeling.
For sure. And, you know, this is a great episode in terms of character development, just totally random away from the philosophy of it. This is a great character development episode, I think, for Odo. Sadly, it's the last time, I think, as best I can recall, that we get to see Dr. Mora. But
you wanted Mora Mora?
I wanted Mora Mora, yeah. Yeah, I like Dr. Mora. That's probably not a popular opinion, but I like Dr. Mora. I like the dynamic between he and Odo. I think there was definitely more story there to tell about the two of them, and I wish we could have seen more. But this is a great episode for character development, just philosophy aside.
Well, I think that's what it does brilliantly, though, right? It's not just a matter of it's a great ethical dilemma and there's great character development. It's that this episode uses that character development to pull your intuitions from where they would go otherwise, right? And that can change your thinking about the ethical dilemma in question. And that's why it's brilliant. So
it is brilliant. So, Zachary, that is four episodes for me, four episodes for you. We actually agree on two of them. My final episode is Dr. Bashir, I presume.
And that was my final episode as well, which you didn't know until right now. So
we agree on three of them. Yes, I love this episode because it delves into an ethical play, I think, that's very relevant for our own time. It was ahead of its time, I think, to some degree, when it first aired, although we were starting to dabble into genetic science and genetic engineering. But
in a very nascent way, though, in the 90s. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Even more so now. I think that there's a relevance that this episode has in terms of really looking at the ethics of that. Even though we take it to the extreme, we're dealing with a human being who's been genetically altered, and that's still very much science fiction for us, I think, for the most part. But it really asks some hard questions, and there are no easy answers because we're not dealing with a Khan Noonien Singh here. We're dealing with Dr. Bashir. This is a character that we know, and love him or hate him, we love him. He's one of the good guys, and we get to see his deepest, darkest secret come to life. And it's not a good thing. It's his parents have broken, you know, probably what is considered at that time, you know, the worst of laws. You know, this is the big one. This is the granddaddy of laws. They've genetically altered their son. And all of us who are Star Trek fans, immediately, you know, the mind goes to Khan and to his followers and the ramifications of that and the eugenics wars and so on and so forth. Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II. I mean, that's exactly what's going off in our minds as Star Trek fans. So this is like the granddaddy of sins, and this skeleton has come to light. It's fell out of his closet, you know, in front of us all for us to see. And, you know, wow, what a secret it is. And we get to see the potential consequences and the actual consequences. We get to see his father, you know, take the fall. There's a lot of ethical things going on in this. I think that, as you said about the Begotten, I think it draws our intuitions in a way that we're not necessarily expecting when all of this first comes to light.
So genetic engineering in Star Trek is a complicated issue. You might use genetic engineering to cure diseases, and that's generally considered to be a good thing because from a utilitarian standpoint, it absolutely is, right? You've minimized harm and suffering for people, right? That's generally a good thing. You can use it to enhance our innate abilities. That's what's going on with Dr. Bashir, right? He has improved intelligence in some way. They kind of hand wave on what that really means inside Deep Space. Okay, he's super intelligent, whatever. Seems pretty ordinary to me. but you might create another Khan Noonien Singh. So you have to be really careful, right? And I think what they've done in Star Trek is just put the brakes on it. Like the dangers outweigh the potential benefits. But undoubtedly, it seems like they're still pursuing some sort of genetic medical research. Like it's okay to cure diseases through genetics. We see that happen many times in Star Trek.
Sure.
You know, we see Dr. Crusher, you know, zooming in and looking at the DNA on the Geordi PowerPoint, right?
The holographic doctor can potentially do that for B'Elanna's baby?
Absolutely. So we know genetic research hasn't stopped. So genetics to cure diseases is okay, but genetic engineering is not okay because they've put the brakes on it because of the dangers involved. There's also kind of a latent naturalism to the notion. There's something unnatural about genetic engineering that they don't find virtuous in the Star Trek universe, right? It's better to let humans evolve naturally according to our own, you know, natural self-selection processes versus artificially introducing, you know, human chosen, you know, selection into our genetic makeup. In Star Trek, they tend to prefer, it seems, a sort of more naturalistic approach to our own evolution, right? You know, letting ourselves self-select naturally versus artificial selection based on someone's idea of how people should be. And it's interesting because on the one hand, you sort of go, yeah, if people could be a little smarter, wouldn't that be a good thing? So, you know, you can understand the impulse to want to do genetic engineering because there is untapped potential. We could have less disease, we could have greatened virtues and heightened abilities, and if we can do that while minimizing the risks of getting another Khan, why wouldn't that be a good thing? So you can definitely understand the appeal. But there's also a pretty direct reference to Nazi eugenics, right? You know, we don't want, you know, space Nazis breeding blonde-haired, blue-eyed humans.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, there's just a lot of factors that come together. So I think this is a particularly complicated issue because there are so many factors. You have to weigh the potential pros and cons of any benefits or risks, you know, and I think the benefits and risks are pretty extreme, right? Heightened intelligence and, you know, radically less disease versus the potential for another con. That's a pretty wide spectrum of consequences, and it's very unpredictable what you might get. If we could predict what the consequence would be, I think people wouldn't have quite the worry about it. Like, oh, we know we can make people a little smarter and make them a little healthier, and we know we're not going to turn them into, you know, evil Superman. And
so,
you know, if
so,
that were
so basically you're saying you have to weigh the pros and
the pros and the cons. Yes.
Con okay, spelled K-H-A. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's all of that. You have to weigh the pros and the cons, and that's really important. But there's also
the
unforeseen danger, and that's why in future, you know, 24th century society in Star Trek, they've put the brakes on genetic engineering. It's verboten. It's not allowed because the potential dangers and the risks are so great, and the consequences are unpredictable. And yet there's this kind of latent connotation of racism and the evils that we saw in Nazi Germany that. You know, that's an unsettled connection. And we wouldn't want to do that either. We don't want designer babies coming out of genetic engineering, right? That's not what the intention of good genetic engineering. So how do you find the middle ground between maximizing the benefits, minimizing the risks, and eliminating the Nazi Germany element of genetic engineering? You know, Star Trek's answer is you put the brakes on and you don't allow it, and that's the end of the story. And what's interesting, of course, about this episode is that Dr. Bashir's family has essentially broken the rules, and Dr. Bashir is genetically engineered in a fairly innocuous way. He's a little more intelligent. He's not very much like Khan. So, you know, about that case in particular, you just don't see what the risks are. I'm not worried about Dr. Bashir trying to, take over the ship or anything like that, so...
Well, I love that it's argued within the episode all of the good that's come from him being genetically engineered.
All the lives he saved.
All the lives he saved. Our friend John Combs over in the Babel Conference responded to our impromptu poll. And Dr. Bashir, I presume, was the episode that John identified as being his pick philosophically. He said the discussion on the ethics of genetic engineering that led to Khan and his war and other unsuccessful results, such as the four patients Bashir later takes in, not to mention how that genetic engineering, and I thought this was a really interesting point, even when successful, as in Bashir's case, puts a disadvantage on those who aren't engineered. I thought that was a very interesting point that John makes there.
Well, that's another aspect, right? There's this sense of fairness of some people are a little more, I mean, in the ordinary sense, like, you know, we're not talking about making another Khan here. Let's just make it a little more ordinary. And I think with Dr. Bashir, we've got a fairly ordinary case of genetic engineering. He's super intelligent, but only a little more super intelligent, right? He's got a little bit of an advantage compared to everyone else on Deep Space Nine.
And we kind of make light of that in the episode when they go to play darts and O'Brien takes him back, you know, like 10 feet. You know, suddenly now he's handicapped a little bit in the dart game because he's, you know.
Well, they keep trying to find ways of reminding you that Dr. Bashir is super intelligent now. They're like, oh, yeah, he's super intelligent, even though he just tried to go in the outdoor. He did that stupid thing in the last episode, but oh, yeah, you know, handicap him in darts. So, but Dr. Bashir aside, you know, there is this issue of fairness. If he is a little more intelligent, what does that mean for the fairness of education? What does that mean for the fairness of career possibilities in Starfleet if he's got an advantage over his colleagues? You know, so, and again, this is a matter of virtues. We think of fairness as a virtue, right? That's not an ethical dilemma per se, but that's a character trait and a state of affairs that we find praiseworthy. And if this changes the balance in terms of fairness, that might be yet another reason to find genetic engineering specious. Not only is it dangerous, it's not fair. It's also potentially like Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot it has going against it. Although Dr. Bashir turned out just fine. So you could plausibly say, well, what's the big deal? He's a little healthier and he's a little more intelligent. We could solve diseases. You know, if you could, I think the trick there is finding a way to maximize the benefit and minimize the risks. And they don't really delve into that too much in Star Trek.
Well, I think they do, but in a way that you really have to look for, because in the Star Trek universe, we have Khan and his followers. All of those are genetic fails. We have the four patients that Bashir takes in later on here in Deep Space Nine. Those are genetic fails. So the only genetic success that we have, really, amongst those potentially hundreds of genetic fails, is Dr. Bashir. So I think to some degree, Star Trek is saying, hey, this doesn't work out more often than it does.
Yeah, but again, I think the trick is trying to flesh out exactly why it's so bad, right? If they could assure you that you're not going to get another Khan out of the deal, and that seems to be what they're worried about, although it sure seems like every time we find an exception to the rule here, every time someone dabbles in genetic engineering, you don't get another Khan, you get more like a Dr. Bashir in the 24th century. So it seems like they've found a way to minimize the dangers. So what's so bad about it? You know, they don't really, I mean, yes, there's this question of fairness, but sure, you can handicap people or you could genetically engineer them too. I mean, if you really want to eliminate the fairness issue, you can say, well, we're not just going to genetically engineer a few people. Let's genetically engineer everyone, the entire population. That gets rid of the issue of fairness, doesn't it?
But Zachary, I think this speaks to an ethical, philosophical leaning that Star Trek has. And I think Star Trek has always had from its very, very beginnings. And that is this idea that absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And that's why it's so obsessed with false gods.
Yeah,
right?
we can go all the way back to Where No Man Has Gone Before from the original series. We take, you know, this kind of unassuming lieutenant commander, Gary Mitchell, and we give him, you know, the power of a god when we break through the galactic barrier, and it corrupts him. He becomes evil and he sees people, human beings, as beneath him. And then we're introduced to Khan, who is not nearly the degree of godness that Gary Mitchell is.
Yeah, and that's what Q is supposed to be in The Next Generation, the very beginning of The Next Generation. And absolutely. Same theme.
Yeah, and so, you know, Khan has that same attitude. You know, these are ants to be squished under my feet, and, you know, I'm superior to them, and I'm going to lord over them, and that's this attitude. And I think that has always been the attitude of Star Trek towards, you know, this kind of Naziistic sort of superiorism philosophy, is that kind of power corrupts absolutely. Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah, and but this,
so that's,
is a little different,
presented
though,
to us as a bad thing until we get to Dr. Bashir. He becomes the exception to the rule.
Right, that's my point. We're not talking about a superhuman with Dr. Bashir. We're talking about someone who's, you know, measurably, but still in a limited way, a little more intelligent than everyone else around him. He's not radically more intelligent. Not from what I can tell by the way he's characterized, and even in the later seasons.
Well, that's just it. I think he is supposed to be...
Well, I know they tell us that, and they really try to sell us on that idea, but he sure doesn't act that much more intelligent than everyone else.
Well, he spent his whole life, Zachary, trying to cover it up, you know.
He's just playing dumb? Is that what you're saying?
Hey, he's been doing it since he took his medical boards.
He's like, this was so hard. He's like, total
preganglionic fiber.
Yeah. He's like, this was so hard, my medical exams. And in his mind, he's going, total cakewalk.
Well, I'm glad we agreed on that episode, because it is strong in terms of the philosophy that's in it with regards to genetic engineering. And
where I think it struggles is that it really anywhere in Star Trek, it doesn't really tell you exactly what's so bad about genetic engineering other than Khan. You can't just keep pointing to Khan and go, oh, you might get another one of those, you might get another one of those. I don't think that's enough to really eliminate the more innocuous kind of genetic engineering we see with Dr. Bashir. You know, you can't say, well, Dr. Bashir might turn into a Khan. Like, well, he's not. So what, you know, there goes that argument. I mean, would the argument against genetic engineering still hold up if Khan had never happened?
Well, that's the flip side of the argument, and I don't think...
So Khan doesn't settle it. I guess that's my point. Intuitions go the other direction, if there were no Khan, then Khan can't settle the argument.
Well, Khan doesn't settle it. The four patients that Dr. Bashir takes in doesn't really settle it. I mean, again, we are presented with more genetic fails than we are given genetic successes. And I think that's Star Trek's case for why this is a bad thing. But I think you're right. You know, the flip side is that there is the potential for a Julian Bashir, who in his own right is a brilliant doctor, and you know, he's acute in ways that, you know, most human beings are not. And, you know, this gives him an advantage over other human beings. I think he becomes the exception in Star Trek and not the rule. And I know that doesn't really satisfy but why is this a bad thing? I know that doesn't satisfy your question, but
this is not something I know a ton about, but it strikes me then that what's needed is some regulation, like there undoubtedly is, that I don't know all that much about because it's not my area of expertise, on genetic engineering. What kinds of things can you do to ensure that you don't get another Khan?
That's what we're saying a little bit within the Star Trek universe, is that the science, while it is advanced, it's not advanced enough to ensure that you're not going to have a fail at the end of that genetic procedure. Well, Zachary, I've got just a few honorable mentions I'll throw out there, kind of lightning round them. I'm not going to dwell on them. Rapture is one of them. Rapture, we've talked about before. That's where Sisko begins to have, you know, these visions that he believes are from the prophets. And, you know, he's at odds with Starfleet and with the Federation, who think that he needs surgery in order to fix a defect. And he wants to continue having them. It's a great episode. It balances kind of this tension between science and religion. It's got some medical ethics in it. There's a lot going on in there. I find very satisfying.
That's absolutely one of my honorable mentions as well. It's one of my favorite episodes. Again, it's one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek, and it's one of my favorite episodes from this season by extension.
So. Yeah, for sure. Another one is For the Uniform. That's the middle of this Michael Eddington arc. So that's the episode where I think we have this kind of unintentional juxtaposition between the Maquis and the Bajoran resistance. And there's a lot of really smart dialogue going on within this episode between this kind of back and forth banter between Captain Sisko and Michael Eddington. It's very personal for Captain Sisko. And again, you're dealing with some really interesting moral and ethical plays that are going on within the episode that we just don't have time to get into. But I love this kind of unintentional juxtaposition, because it's easy for us to say, oh, you know, those Bajorans, that resistance, those were freedom fighters, but the Maquis are terrorists. And we're given a different picture of the Maquis in this episode that sounds a whole lot like the Bajoran resistance. And I find it really satisfying, and it definitely pulls your intuitions.
Well, that I think that you hit the nail on the head. The Maquis and the Bajoran resistance are structurally similar to each other, and yet they pull our intuitions in such different ways. And both of them are a mirror for the Federation's mindset, right? Mm-hmm. You know, almost a critique of the Federation's, idealistic mindset in the 24th century.
And I love the fact that Eddington drops in there, Les Miserables, and the kind of contrasts how he views himself as you know, the hero of his own story.
And from Sisko's standpoint, you basically, with Eddington in particular, you get a betray of trust. So you wouldn't appeal to Eddington as the deciding factor about which way to read the Bajorans and about which way to read the Maquis. Because with Eddington in particular, the thing that really rubbed Sisko the wrong way is the betray of trust.
And the way Eddington paints him as petty, you know, with that Les Miserables reference. So I appreciate that. That's one of my favorite works of literature. My last honorable mention is an episode, Business as Usual. That is a great episode where Quark finds himself working as an arms dealer. This was also mentioned on our impromptu poll by Delegate Jack Hoskinson, who said, I think Business as Usual is a really strong season 5 philosophy episode. Definitely an ethics episode, and one that fits nicely into debates we are having in the wake of all the mass shootings happening in the United States right now. I think the wonderful thing about this is that we really get to see the character development of Quark in a very philosophical way. He is balancing who he was and who he's become as a result of his time and the influence that the Federation's had upon him. He's got a conscience now.
In a way, arms dealing is structurally similar to the ethical issues with genetic engineering we were just talking about, because the proliferation of weapons at large, a large number of weapons out there in this, you know, Ferengi arms dealer way of thinking, whether in, you know, small weapons for a large number of individuals or large weapons for, you know, governments at large, you know, there are unintended large scale, long-term consequences to that, just like there are to, you know, the risks involved in genetic engineering that we were talking about.
So Zachary, any final thoughts on season 5 of Deep Space Nine?
I think the surprising thing for me to realize in thinking about the season as a whole is how much the season is concerned with not just ethical dilemmas in a consequentialist utilitarian kind of sense, but in a virtue ethic sense. Like, what character traits do we find praiseworthy and blameworthy, and what kinds of situations can we put people in dramatically that allow those character traits to become visible on the screen for us to appreciate or criticize or talk about on Metatrex? But, you know, again, that's a different variety of ethics, because so many times we talk about ethics in terms of dilemmas, a large number of people versus a small number of people, or this consequence versus that consequence. And here we're talking about which kind of people do we want to be and which kinds of people do we not want to be. And that's a very different way of thinking about ethics than ethical dilemmas.
As I said at the top of the podcast, I think this particular season of Deep Space Nine is all about these kind of existential crisis that these individuals are having here. And it's all set against the backdrop of the Dominion War. You know, it really is about balancing the pros and cons of the situations that they find themselves in, the choices that they have to make, and weighing who they are as a result of and in the midst of all of that. So it's a wonderfully strong season. Zachary, we've got an incredible list here. I'm just going to recap for our listeners. this is our list. We have Children of Time, Nor the Battle to the Strong, Let He Who Is Without Sin, The Ascent, The Ship, The Begotten, Dr. Bashir, I presume, and our three honorable mentions, Rapture, For the Uniform, and Business as Usual. That, listeners, is Essential Trek Philosophy from Deep Space Nine, Season 5.
That's a great list. You and I must have watched this season a time or two to come up with that list.
Just a few times. But I have to say that in an unusually strong season where, as I said before, I really think that the writers and producers, and for that matter, actors, were just in many, many ways bringing their A game for this 30th anniversary of Star Trek. I just, to be able to pull, you know, just a handful of episodes out of this mix was really an incredible feat in and of itself. And I can truly say that these aren't just great episodes of Deep Space Nine. They're fantastic episodes of Star Trek.
We're really seeing the golden age of Star Trek here. You know, we're from episode to episode to episode. It was amazingly brilliant all the time. And there was so much of it. And it was an amazing time. Yeah. I like reminiscing about it because it was so fun to watch the first time around. But I think it's so intriguing to me that we can keep circling back to these episodes 20 years later and find new meaning in them. And
yeah,
I'm constantly, while we do that every time we record Metatreks, you know, whether we're talking about a topic or about a particular episode, when you look at an entire season, you realize, wow, this whole season is still so rich and still so relevant. And it means slightly different things to us now than it did 20 years ago. But that's amazing. That's why we're still talking about it.
Yeah, all pros and no cons.
Well, speaking of that, Mike, it's been fun talking about the pros and the cons today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
For an opening episode to get that relationship, like you could see that crew really had been working together for 7 years, which is so wow. Not normal for a launch, for a first episode, right? Because you've got the odds, but they seemed to have working forever together. The camaraderie that they had, the trust that they have with each other.
To the journey!
And then, you know, they're all up on the bridge and everyone's like, oh, what's B'Elanna doing with her day off? And Tom's like, oh, she's binge-watching Bill Nye. She's been there, you know, in her PJs since 8 o'clock this morning.
I can picture she's been watching Bill Nye all day. Tom comes home and she says to Tom, you know, Tom, have you ever thought about wearing a bow tie?
But if he's on the bridge and says all that, would Captain Janeway know who Bill Nye the Science Guy is?
Yeah. It's Janeway.
The 602 Club.
So I graduated from high school in 1984. So this film came out in my, sophomore year in high school? So that was like prime formative years for me. This is, you know, this and Mad Max were the R-rated movies that me and all of my friends wanted to go see.
Meta Treks.
It knows to point that out and say, that's red. You know, it will correctly identify the red shirt as red, but really perceives it like we perceive blue.
I knew Kirk should have wore his green tunic when he went to fight the Gorn.
Yeah, it would have made all the difference.
It would have made all the difference.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on the iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we would love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways that you can share your thoughts with us. The best place to join in the conversation with us is in the Babel Conference, our listeners-only discussion group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select Metatreks. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter @TrekFM and on Facebook @facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, speaking of contact information, Mike, when you're not busy doing jello shots with Dr. Morrow, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, pretty much if you type cmichael1701 into any social media, you'll probably find me. I'm always on Facebook. That's where you'll find me most often, certainly around the Babel Conference, over on Twitter at cmichael1701, occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701. And you can always check out my blog about my journey to publish my novel, as well as a little bit about life. That is cmichael1701.wordpress.com. And Zachary, when you're not hauling my butt uphill in the snow to...
Both ways.
Where can our listeners find you around the interwebs and on the network?
Well, when we're not talking about Star Trek and philosophy here on MetaTrek, you can find me over on To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts over there, Kay Shaw and Suzanne Williamson. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me over there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, we invite you to become a patron of the network through Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these podcasts each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and the jiggliest individual we know. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Che Mutala, our Patreon manager. And a special thank you and a shout out to our four associate producers here on MetaTrex. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, my co-host over on To the Journey. You can find her under the Twitter handle at ChocoWeeble. Norman Lau, you can find him at Starfighter1701. And our newest associate producer, Mark Walker from Parts Unknown.
And Zachary, I want to give a big thank you to everyone who responded to our impromptu poll today over at the Babel Conference. Appreciate their feedback and keep it coming. We might mention your comment here on MetaTrex.
Absolutely. We appreciate the enthusiasm, the support, and the ideas.
And Zachary, we want to give a special thank you to our sponsors here at MetaTrex and Trek FM.
Absolutely. Be sure to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. Also, check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, just visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers or no jello molds have gone before.